It's never too early for Lowe's Black Friday deals. Snag some of our biggest savings of the season right now, like 25% off select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees. And get yourself free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit before the Black Friday rush. Because everyone loves free stuff, right? Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
It's The Wonky Show. We're talking about the fee rise and newly announced government priorities for the sector, debating how institutions might collaborate better in the future to respond to calls for greater efficiency, and reflecting on the results of the US presidential election. It's all coming up.
As Democrats in the US are kind of flummoxed, or kind of, you know, consternation about what he represents isn't enough to attract people to our side. And likewise, we have to have a better vision of what it is we're trying to do.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to raise the cap of HE policy discussion this week, as usual, we have three fantastic guests. In Bristol, it's Brooke Storchurch, Chief Executive Officer at Guild HE. Brooke, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi. Highlight of the week was on Monday. I took my team for a team building day. We went to the place just around the corner from our office in London, where we did lots of good conversational work as well as a movement class to push us out of our comfort zones, which everyone really enjoyed.
And Camberwell, it's Johnny Rich, Chief Exec at the Engineering Professors Council. And Push, Johnny, your heart of the week, please.
I think it has to be the maintenance loans going up, although we're going to be talking later, I expect, about how high a highlight that actually was.
And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's news editor. Michael, your heart of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Hi, everyone. I think best thing I've done this week was go out to a nice bonfire night celebration with my family on Tuesday, which made a nice change from Halloween, where we sort of barricaded ourselves in our house so all the teenagers couldn't come and ring our bell.
Right. We start the week with fees and a big set of announcements from the government in Westminster. Michael, walk us through it, please.
Yes. So as I'm sure everyone will have spotted, the government has agreed to a rise in undergraduate tuition fees in England from the next academic year. So it's the first time in a good long while. And the fee cap is going to go up. For full-time students, it will be up to £9,535 a year. I mean, I think we've all become very used to it being £9,250 for a long time. So it's a 3.1% increase, which is based on a projection of what inflation is going to be like, I think in January 2026. So, in that sense, it's not really an increase if that forecast plays out, but at least it's not a real terms cut as it's been for year on year on year for quite a long time. And in fact, this, the interesting thing for, you know, for us has been that Wonky was the first to report that this announcement was coming. In our Monday coverage, we said, you know, we understand it's imminent, it's coming pretty soon, but I think we weren't expecting it quite so soon. It came on Monday afternoon. The announcement was a couple of hours in advance, was all over the press. I will note with no comments that a leak inquiry has been set up by the Department for Education. We got the fee rise announcement. There's also the maintenance announcement that Johnny's mentioned. So this is, you know, this was perhaps less of a surprise. We expected it has been continuing. It's this scheduled increase that's based on, again, inflation forecasts. So it could or could not be a real terms increase. It depends how accurate those forecasts are. The interesting thing in the announcement was, it was Bridget Phillipson, the Education Secretary, speaking in the Commons, and she said these two things here, these sort of, you know, twiddles that we kind of knew were coming, were the start of deeper change, she said, and she set out some stuff. She's also written to vice chancellors with a few more things and has said that Labour's kind of grander plan for higher education reform is going to arrive by next summer. And in the meantime, she spelled out various different areas, around access, flexible study, stuff like that, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And I'll just also finally mention there's a dangling question here about whether universities are actually going to all be able to implement these fee rises for already enrolled students, because there's a sort of contractual question here about, you know, whether you're allowed to raise tuition fees for students who you already have a contract with.
Right, yes. And Speaker Lindsay Horrell was pretty upset, wasn't he, about the leaks before Bridget Phillipson announced the rise. We have a clip.
Can I just say, can we take it from now that there will be a full inquiry into how this has happened, that everybody will be brought in, questioned, and you will then up update us with a full inquiry. That's what I really want.
Mr. Speaker, I can give you that undertaking and I will speak to officials on the matter as you
request. Oh, man. I'm going to expect a knock on the door there. enormous amount to digest here. Brooke, I'll start with you. I think, you know, as well as the fees announcement, we've seen the first indication of what Secretary of State's priorities are for the sector leading into some kind of bigger reform package. And that's quite important, isn't it, for universities?
I think it is. I think, you know, there are some positives as we already touched on, certainly announcements about increase in maintenance loans. We are quite keen to see more support for students. So, you know, we have further questions, I'm sure as many do, about whether there's some movement around maintenance grants as well. Fee increase, I think, should be seen as a positive, responsive move from the government. Yes, it's small and, you know, there's other discussions, I know, on the table about what might be really needed to underpin financial sustainability in a bigger sense. But I think we're also quite well aware, those of us working in the sector, certainly those of us who we represent, that you know, a bit of a tinkering around the edges is not going to be good enough. It's not good enough from our perspective in terms of the serious challenges within the sector. But also, we know that government wants to think bigger picture, and I think now is the time, and it's positive, I think, to see some messages coming from DfE at the moment that they intend to move that forward. Of course, that opens the door for additional questions around what does that look like and what will it mean. But I think it's an opportunity that we need to be willing to step into.
On the point about students already there, yes, it is the case that the increase in tuition fees will cover students who are already studying. In some ways, it isn't for the government to clarify the position because, of course, higher education institutions are autonomous and will need to be clear with their students about what the impact of the increase in fees will be for them. I think I would be right in saying, and I will correct myself if I'm not right in saying, that for most, the assumption would be that the increase in tuition fees will go ahead in the way in which we've described.
Johnny, from a kind of student point of view or graduate, it's probably a kind of stopgap. It's probably a kind of stopgap position, isn't it, for at least the next couple of years? But how do you rate it? How do you rate the kind of the overall deal that's been done here in terms of allowing fees to go up a little bit, the stuff on maintenance, etc.?
I'm a bit confused by the politics of it because it does seem odd to announce a stopgap. I mean, an emergency measure was required, both for students and for universities. But by doing a one-year stopgap, rather than giving a clearer indication of the long-term plan, she potentially takes the hit, the political hit, this year and next year and every year that she has to make an announcement again. So politically, I'm not sure that it's been done in a way that limits the damage to Bridget Phillipson. But, you know, all credit to her for doing the right thing and not doing it for political reasons, I guess. But there's another thing, which is around the financial rules here. Now, I'm not going to claim to be any kind of an expert on budget financial accounting, but there was a change in the rules announced in the budget, moving from this thing PSND to something called PSNUFL. And yeah, without going into the whys and wherefores of that, basically it made lending money to students more attractive to the Treasury than it had been. I think that kind of paved the way for this change to get through the Treasury. But that calls into question, why couldn't it go a little bit further, especially on maintenance? Maintenance grants wouldn't have cost that much more to reintroduce maintenance grants for the poorer students, and that would have been a really significant return to the architecture of opportunity that she wants to promote.
I don't think those are off the table, though, Johnny. I mean, I think that we shouldn't read the lack of reference to them in this short-term announcement, which is really what it is, as a kind of we've taken a decision that's not important. And I would say that about anything that we're looking for. Oh, we haven't seen it said, it's probably off the table. Absolutely not. I would take this, actually. That's why I think the framing for me is a bit more positive than that. It is a bit risky for Bridget Phillipson to put her neck out at this moment and say, look, I'm going to approve an inflationary increase right now. Why? while we think about bigger term issues. I think it's where we want them to be because there are, as you say, real issues, and they've been clear about the issues around access. I think for me, the concerns are it feels a bit harking back to kind of, you know, ill-defined and kind of historic complaints about the sector, you know. So we'll give you a bit of an increase now, but we want, you know, that quid pro quo. We want more widening access. We want poor quality addressed. I think, you know, again, I have real questions about what does that mean in practice? You know, where isn't it working well enough in terms of the access agenda? Where is the problem that poor quality exists? Because really, any assessment of poor quality is an assessment of OFS as a regulator to uphold that quality. So where are the systemic issues that you really want fixed? And are our individual institutions in the position to fix that? Or is it more of a system analysis? And therefore, what kind of system intervention do we need? And you know, anyone listening will be unsurprised to hear me talk about the need for sector coordination, that kind of oversight for us in order to make sure that we're not all left thinking as individual institutions, we need to solve problems that are actually beyond our remit to solve, but therefore we should be willing to participate in that and advise and consult and come up with a kind of proof of concept testing bed, but probably not expected to kind of solve those nuts.
I think that's exactly right. I also think, Michael, what was partly interesting about this, both Johnny and Brooke mentioned the politics of the announcement this week, but we didn't see a ginormous pushback, did we? We didn't see this becoming a kind of totemic political moment that's going to actually damage them. We've talked on this podcast and we've written on the site for the last couple of years endlessly about all that research that showed how unpopular fee rises are amongst the public as a pretext to, you know, any government potentially not doing anything here. But they did take a plunge, and there hasn't been, apart from the usual quarters, from what I can tell anyway, any kind of real political harm.
Yeah, well, I think the timing, it just in the sort of wider news cycle, has probably been helpful. It was a bit of a Monday story. You know, by Tuesday, it was the American elections. Last week, it was the budget, which is still sort of rumbling on. You know, tomorrow, it will be something else. And, you know, realistically, the idea that it's going to be a huge scandal leading to loads of protests, that tuition fees have been held at their real value for a year, shouldn't be a story. Really, the story should have been in the past. The government has cut funding for universities again every single year when it did it.
This is a decision not to cut it further, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. But the timing, the wider question of timing, I think, is quite interesting. The thing that really caught my eye in this letter to vice chancellors was that Bridget Phillipson says that Labour will set out their kind of wider thinking by next summer on higher education reform, which would be after the multi-year spending review has been announced, which to me is a little odd. I'm still trying to kind of wrap my head around that. You would think, because, you know, there needs to be consultation, there potentially needs to be sort of, you know, legislative moves to do things that are not just the sort of business as usual of raising fees and maintenance with inflation forecast.
I've got a theory about that. I think it's kind of probably a good thing that it's not tied so closely to a spending review. I think what it probably means is we're not going to see in a short term, or even possibly the medium to long term, any major rethink of the fees and funding system. And Johnny mentioned Snuffle, without getting into the nuts and bolts of it, the borrowing rules that Rachel Reeves has adopted would pretty much completely rule out anything like a graduate tax system under Rachel Reeves as Chancellor, and, you know, probably for the lifetime of this government. So the kind of the terms of what will be reviewed and looked at, I mean, there's already a kind of framework around that. We've got our fees and loan system, of which, you know, the parameters are very much on the table, as are kind of the repayment measures and mechanisms. But what we probably aren't going to see in the spring or the summer is let's tear up the whole system and, you know, come up with a new funding model, which in some ways is good because it gives the sector a kind of some planning. And on the other part of that, which I guess is where I'm saying is there's some positives here, is that, you know, there's a kind of wealth of policy and intervention that the government might make in a positive sense that the sector can now contribute to. And as I say, where the parameters are a little bit clearer, I think, than they were before. So if we can sort of divorce the big spending conversation from the kind of HE policy question, if we've got a kind of system in place, then we know what we need to be asking for, which is, you know, those parameters, as I say, you know, moving those dials up and down for students, for graduates, for universities, to make the system progressive, to make keep universities on the even keel. And then we can have a proper grown-up conversation about how we configure the sector, how we can, you know, do the things, other things Bridget was saying about opportunity, and how universities can power growth. And these are the kind of, these in some ways are the more interesting interesting conversations.
Well, I have to stop you there because I don't think that that's quite right. I think that the way the system works is driven by, you know, it's the follow the money thing. The current fee system isn't fit for purpose, if you ask me, because it's premised on the idea of encouraging universities to chase student demand with virtually no regard or responsibility for national skills needs. And that sets different interests at odds with each other. I mean, I don't think anybody is behaving irresponsibly in this. It's just that you set up the rules of the game through the rules of the funding. And this leads to the situation where we get all these unfair accusations about Mickey Mouse degrees, poor outcomes, skimping on contact hours, because everybody is looking at it in that those transactional terms. And it also puts universities in competition with each other, which undermines exactly the kind of collaborations and efficiencies and reforms that the government wants to see and that we'll come back to later, I'm sure. And meanwhile, employers get off scot-free in terms of investing in HE, but they're also denied any skin in the game or influence over what is taught or how. So I do think that before we, or in order to get onto the important questions that you're raising, Mark, about you know, how is the system, how is the HE system itself configured, we have to talk about how the funding is configured, and we have to set it up so that it incentivizes the right things. So to that end, the government does have to think radically about the system and upending the cart. And to some extent, LLE, which they've now committed to, is going to upend the cart anyway. So while they've got the whole cart up on jack, they might as well mend the whole thing. So I think that the political damage, yes, it hasn't been as big as it could have been. We haven't seen huge outcries in Parliament or anything like that, or in the press. But I do think that it's not just how big is the outcry, it's who is the outcry with. And a lot of the outcry is coming from the left, from a Labour's base, and from young people who feel lied to about fees. The fact is, the manifesto was very clear. We are going to create a secure future for higher education. They couldn't have been clearer about the fact that that implied fees going up and implied deeper reform as well, or instead. So there's no lie that's been told here. But the feeling that once upon a time there was the pledge to abolish fees is still hanging around. And I think it's not, is there a wide complaint? It's who is the complaint with that may do the longer term damage?
I think that's why we're still waiting to find out more about what Bridget Phillipson really meant when she said to rebalance the funding system in order to acknowledge the public good that higher education is. You know, a lot of us watching the sector and listening to those words interpreted that to mean a rebalancing in terms of who is responsible for the cost of higher education away from the individual student, which is where we are now. It's too heavily, and in fact, Bridget Phillipson has said that it's too heavily weighted towards the individual student and not weighted, heavily enough to the public purse. So I'm certainly hoping to see an acknowledgement of that public good via what would have been the teaching grant is now the strategic priorities grant. Who knows what it will be going forward, or some other mechanism, because I don't necessarily agree with the statement employers get off scot-free. I think they invest into, taxation and business rates and all sorts of other taxes are taken from employers, which do feed back into that, treasury pocketbook. But I'd like to see some of that money, in whatever form coming back into our higher education institutions in order for us to then look at what do we mean when we say we have a strong internationally leading higher education system? Is it the right size and shape to do what we need it to do, which is both to unlock opportunity for individuals and as well as to fuel economic growth, which does mean, to your point, Johnny, that we are, developing the higher level skills needed for the economy, both what's needed now, but also what's needed into the future. And currently, we just don't have that kind of awareness or skills capability within government or central planning operations. I have some skepticism about whether the birth of Skills England will be to be the kind of, solution to that problem that we have talked about for years and years and years in the sector. It's all to play for, as far as I can see. But we need to have our skin in the game there. We need to really be influencing and working with government and working within ourselves to try to influence the next, you know, the next few steps in the direction.
Yeah, I think what Brooke says is exactly right. There's now, you know, coming up on a year where the sector can be really, really making its case to the government. Debbie has set this out very well in a blog on Wonky this morning about, you know, there will now be a flurry of sort of engagement and meetings and roundtables, possibly even some consultations. You know, this is now the moment for the longer term thinking. I find the criticism that this, and you know, we saw it in some newspaper headlines and elsewhere, that this is a kind of, you know, a stopgap solution, is just sort of bananas. I mean, I don't know in what world people were expecting Labour to come in and make changes to the student finance system, either for this academic year or for next. I mean, you know, it's November. The fee levels and the maintenance levels need to be set now, while applications are already going in. And, you know, there's no time to consult or to make legislative change in advance of that. It needed to be announced, and they've done it. And now the proper longer term thinking begins.
But they've basically got two options next summer: to either announce a review, an August style review, or to come up with a plan there and then and start consulting on that. And if they're going to arrive at a plan, doing it in a vacuum for, you know, behind closed doors for the next year, the advantage of a consultation is it is out in the open a lot more. And I'm anxious about who gets listened to in a behind closed doors exercise. I think that it might well move to a much faster solution. And who knows, it may end up in a much better solution. But it is a less transparent approach. And I would like to be feeding into that, but I don't know exactly how to go about that if it's happening with who knows whom and who's got the best lobbying machinery. So what will we get next summer? Will we get a good plan that is consulted on and then hopefully goes forward? Or will we get a bad plan that causes upset? Or will we get a review that kicks things further down the line? And yeah, only one of those options looks particularly good to me, and even that has a downside.
I suspect we'll know more in the coming weeks, because we'll get a sense of the questions that they're asking, and you'll be able to, you know, we'll be able to fill in the gaps in terms of how to influence. You know, I think just call them up, Johnny, and tell them what you think how to organise a higher education system.
As you know, I would like to see a graduate employer contribution scheme. I've written papers and articles about it extensively. The government the civil service knows very well about it, and they know it will save them $8 billion a year, which not my figures, London Economics figures. There's not really a downside to it, and it all sounds too good to be true, which seems to be the only real argument against it.
Snuffle. Unfortunately, Rachel Reeves doesn't like it. It's not happening, Johnny. Anything else? Anything else you've got? Anything within the borrowing rules? Because I don't think you're getting that. I'm sorry, but I don't think you're getting that one.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just going back around to what we were talking about with the borrowing rules. Like you said, Mark, it sort of does rule out a kind of graduate tax approach, I think. But the other question is around maintenance grants, which we mentioned before. And I do worry that, you know, we know there was an active discussion going on between DfE and Treasury over the last couple of months about whether that could be part of the announcement that we've just had. And we know from the leaks to the press that the Treasury said no. They said that maintenance grants were too expensive, and you know, especially with the new borrowing rules, it's not such a big deal for the government to, you know, raise and perhaps in future raise more generously the maintenance loan, or, you know, not, well, we need to stop talking about raising, but, you know, make proper changes to the, you know, the income thresholds that give the, you know, it's ridiculous. But I do worry that the new borrowing rules will push the Treasury further away from wanting to go down the maintenance grant reintroduction route.
That sounds like a challenge for Jackie Smith and Bridget Phillipson to overcome then, you know, if their ambition is to widen access. And my challenge was, you know, in what way, where should we improve? How should we improve? And, you know, one of the key mechanisms we know is crucial to widening expanding access is addressing the financial barrier to accessing higher education, and maintenance grants is a really useful evidence-based tool for doing that. So I think, you know, in some regards, it's a bit of a quid pro quo on that one as well, although I wouldn't suggest we start, you know, playing hardball around access.
They need to start changing the language as well, because everyone in government should be banned from ever talking again about students paying fees. It's not students who pay fees, it's graduates who pay fees, or who pay contributions in the form of repayments of the loans. And getting this wrong so consistently exaggerates the political hit for any party in government, and it encourages prospective students to be put off. And it makes poorer parents especially feel very wary and very concerned about, are you really going to, we haven't got the money to pay for that, and are you really going to take on all of this debt, and there's no guarantee you'll get a good degree or a job at the end of it. It's no wonder that it's so damaging, and we have to change the language and the way that we talk about this so that it actually represents what the system is.
Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Holly Duglan, formerly Registrar and Secretary at Whittle University College. And this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about market exit. Earlier this year, Whittle University College, a small specialist provider of further and higher education in Essex, merged with Anglia Ruskin University. This was the culmination of a planned market exit initiated by the University College. We had to accept that we couldn't deliver a credible route to financial sustainability in the current operating environment. And so the governing body determined that the student interest was best served by seeking a merger before it was too late. We were not alone in this, and some large and small providers continue to face a bleak financial outlook. This week's announcement that tuition fees will rise in line with inflation provides some relief, but it's unlikely to be a game changer for providers struggling with significant cash flow problems. This makes it all the more important that governing bodies are presented with a realistic appraisal of the institution's situation, and that they plan credible worst-case scenarios at the earliest opportunity. We owe it to students and staff to have these difficult conversations, and where necessary, to put the work into identifying orderly routes to market exit.
Now, a couple of major reports out on efficiency in higher education. Johnny, talk us through them, please.
There's no such thing as a free lunch when it comes to the fee increase, or even free table scraps in this case, because when Bridget Phillipson bestowed universities with the great munificence of an extra £285 a year, she did say that there would be strings attached. She talked about in her speech about major reform based on five priorities. And actually, I found it very interesting that those priorities quite closely aligned with the UUK blueprint that was published last month. They were pretty much the same things that UUK was saying should be priorities. Anyway, one of these was that there needed to be a drive for sustained efficiency. And Bridget Phillipson has written to VCs to explain further. And I think it's worth quoting the letter, which says, adapting to the changed context of the higher education sector over the next decade will require a more fundamental re-examination of business models and much less wasteful spending. And given that more than 70 universities have been making redundancies, I'm sure their staff will be nodding in agreement about all the wasteful spending on, you know, diamond encrusted toilet brushes or whatever. But sarcasm aside, it isn't clear where exactly there is all this waste, or it's not clear to me anyway. And she talks about in her letter the need for greater collaboration and transparency, and that universities will be held to account for value for money. And her speech also talked about significant changes at OFS, and so maybe there'll be new regulation, new or different regulation around some of these things, and around value for money and collaboration.
Yeah, and we've got a clip of what Bridget Phillipson was saying about efficiency.
Lying beneath these challenges must be a further transformation, a renewed drive for efficiency. Students and taxpayers support the cost of our universities. They are right to expect that every penny is spent effectively. We will not accept wasteful spending. Universities must rise to the challenge, and that means ensuring that the pay of their top teams is fair and justifiable. I'm determined that our world-class higher education sector does not merely survive in the years ahead, but thrives.
Right, and Michael, we've had two reports this week, haven't we, looking at this very issue. One of them we co-authored with KPMG.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, bang on time. We've been thinking, and others in the sector have been thinking thinking. And we know this thinking's going on, as you know, as Johnny said, it was also in the UUK blueprint. But yeah, Wonky and KPMG over the summer, we've been having conversations with people in and around the sector and in you know, in university leadership to talk about, you know, what would it actually mean to be radical about efficiency. And this doesn't just mean, you know, efficiency not as cuts, which I think is the key thing, because people obviously hate the word efficiency because they know what it actually means. But what if it actually means something different, I think is the point here. So we've published some initial findings. There's more to come. So there were, you know, suggestions around, you know, three themes, I think, came out that we're going to write more about. So one is around credit transfer. One's about sort of regulatory change, having a kind of statutory commissioner who would convene collaboration in things that would stand to be collaborated on. And the other one is back office in digital sort of shared services, that old chestnut. And also another thing people were really stressing was about, you know, regional collaboration being very important. On the topic of back office and digital, there's a fantastic report out from JISC and KPMG, again, which is looking at shared approaches to digital data and technology. It's sort of kind of trying to fight back against this default approach. It says, you know, where individual institutions just want to do things by themselves. They think there's no value in collaborating, or at least that, you know, they will be investing money that isn't giving them a competitive advantage if they try to cooperate. But, you know, it also does make the point that there's this big, big technical obstacle, you know, in that all universities have got different systems, and even different departments and different bits of universities have different systems. So yeah, there's savings to be made, partly because the government wants it. I'm not sure quite how much policy there will be behind that, or if it's just the usual remarks, but also, you know, the sector desperately needs it, with things like employer national insurance and all kinds of other pressures, meaning, you know, savings need to come from somewhere. And nobody wants that to be through cuts.
Brooke, there's lots of interesting things in here, aren't there? Lots of ideas for how different sorts of institutions might collaborate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Michael's point is really astute around the fact that we need to reframe the discussion around efficiencies away from, you know, interpreting it as financial cuts and towards, radical efficiency. I was one of those honored to be invited to the KPMG Wonky event around radical efficiency, and took away actually some really interesting observations around just how much duplication there is that could be slimmed, and the fact that actually collaborative activities in order to find efficiencies is already well within our sector. DK has a good article on Wonky yesterday on the back of the JISC and KPMG report, you know, reminding us all that UCAS admissions services and the Janet internet connectivity and UK UPC for procurement, you know, there are already a good handful of examples where this does work for us, and it allows us not only to reduce some of the burden that would fall on individual institutions, but also to ensure a best approach, a higher quality approach for that. And I think that's incredibly important as we move forward to think about not only how we can make those gains, but how we can do it in an inclusive way, so that we're not just building a kind of efficiency process that meets the needs of large-scale, multi-faculty, you know, campus-based universities, the kind of thing that we know government thinks about when they think about university, but actually our smaller institutions, our specialist institutions, those that really bring the diversity of the sector, that is the richness that we prioritize and prize. But it also leads us on to questions about, you know, what needs to be true for that to work. And that's a lot of the nuts and bolts stuff we were getting into in the workshop earlier. And I hope we dive further into it at the Festival of HE next week. I certainly reflect on it in what I've written about the credit framework stuff coming out shortly. But, you know, what do we need in order to really think in that kind of radical way? And it's fun thinking, but also it's work that needs to be done now in order to shape and advise on the next steps, rather than feel they're being done to us through either, as you say, Michael, kind of clear policy, or just the impact of the kind of rhetoric around wasteful spending, you know, which is really quite inflammatory, but doesn't have a lot of, you know, it's kind of maybe we see examples of it, but how widespread is that? And how do you approach that if institutions are autonomous, or, you know, it just leaves us with a number of wicked problems.
I mean, Johnny, lots of, there are ideas in these reports. I mean, we've been talking in the sector for a long time about mergers, but perhaps there are more practical things that could be done short of those that could help answer this kind of this challenge of how to be more efficient in a kind of radical way.
Yeah, the idea of mergers. I mean, you can also have federal federal relationships between universities, a bit like multi-school, multi-academy trusts. But the interesting thing about multi-academy trusts is I don't think that they've really saved any money, and they haven't saved money. Sometimes what they have meant is that schools manage to do more with the same amount, but they're not able to make cuts. And, you know, because there's things that you can do together and achieve together that can't be achieved as easily on your own. So you don't bother on your own, but you might try together, but you haven't saved any money in the process. And I expect the same would apply to HE. There are places that we can go on an efficiency hunt and greater collaboration. Brooke and I have talked before about more collaboration on outreach, and I think that Guild HE is a really good example of an organization that could be doing more collaborative outreach, because small specialist institutions can't necessarily do the outreach at scale that they would love to do. You know, they're critical to wider access, but they're not able to do some of the outreach work. But together they could, because they have the national reach. And Guild HE already does this through Guild HE research working together. So, you know, these collaborations do exist, and the sector's quite good at them. And I have to say, you know, I've worked in HE, I've worked in the private sector, and I've worked in the third sector. And one of the hardest things I've ever done has always been collaborations. I have put together multi-million pound collaborations, but they're difficult and they need to be built on shared interest. Everyone has to be on the same page, and they need to be easier than doing it alone, and disproportionately better than doing it alone. And when they work, it's not because they're cheaper, it's because there is no alternative and they're achieving things that wouldn't have happened unless there were a collaboration. And so I do think it's worth just reflecting for a moment on the drive for efficiency and collaboration in universities, and whether how this sort of lines up with the government's own stated desire for greater regional devolution. The idea is that government should be more divided up into regional chunks, which brings with it potential duplication, but universities should be encouraged to operate more like, I don't know, franchised branches of KFC or something. I'm being extremist here, but
we'll get complaints for that.
I'd like to speak up briefly, actually, for inefficiency as well. I'm no fan of waste, honestly. I'm not, but I do think it's worth saying universities aren't production lines. There is productivity in the inefficiencies. I mean, is it efficient for universities to support research that isn't fully funded? Is it efficient for universities to promote wider access? Is it efficient for universities to be, I don't know, cultural centers for local communities? I could go on. You know, these are not particularly efficient ways of processing, but I would say there's a fundamental question here, which is, what does efficiency mean that we lose?
Yeah, I mean, maybe efficiency is sort of is the wrong term entirely, and we need to just, you know, find a new way of badging it. Because when you put it like that, I think people will agree, and I would agree. But, you know, if you think of some of these examples in the JISC KPMG report about, you know, things like sort of UCAS or JANET, I mean, no one would go, oh, like, I wish we were handling our own admissions, and I wish we had got to set up our own internet provider and stuff, like, you know. But that sort of stuff, it doesn't feel like efficiency, it just feels like the sort of the fabric, the landscape, and, you know. But as soon as you start telling people, okay, change how you're doing things, and especially if it feels like you're saying do things in a more production line kind of way, then, you know, university staff are fantastic at digging their heels in over that, and often with very good reason.
One area where we could have, in addition to access, so access is one area where we would get real gains in better collaboration. Another one is accommodation, especially on a regional basis. Not only can institutions collaborate, but that could be a form of rent control, which would also ease local housing markets. And it means long-term investment in assets that don't lose their value. So I think that there's a really strong argument for collaboration in accommodation and housing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's an argument for, let's stop some of the money that's going into the sector leaving the sector, right? You know, when you think of the amount of maintenance that's going on, accommodation costs.
You can read more about any of this, full of links in the show notes. Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be with City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe. Here's a hidden history of higher education.
So the pass degree was the original degree. Reforms in the 19th century led to the creation of honours exams, top-ups, whereby you course, but you added an honours exam. You could add more than one honours exam as more were added. Slowly the requirements for honours became more onerous, so the requirements for the pass degree faded away. In the 19th century, this led to a clear distinction between the reading men and the pass men. The reading men, who were following the honours courses, grew in number. The pass men were seen as a good part of the mission of the university, what Vivian Green describes as the finishing schools of the upper and middle classes. There were plenty of examples of how pass men got on perfectly well with their studies, but not so well with the examinations. As an example, Henry Chaplin was chastised by the Dean of Christchurch, who said, "As far as I can gather, you seem to regard Christchurch as a hunting box. You're hardly ever in college, and I must request you to either vacate your rooms to make way for someone who can benefit from their studies at the university." The student replied, "But what do you expect me to do?" Dean said, "You must go in for an examination." And so he did. It was a bit of a novelty to him, but he did very well. So the Dean summoned him back to say, "You've done tremendously well with this. I must congratulate you on your excellent performance, but now you must go in for the honour schools. You've shown us your abilities. You will become a credit, not only to this house, but to the university, as I expect you'll be very successful." But Chaplin said, "If only you told me before, I would have done so. But after my last interview with you, in which you intimated that I'd have to vacate my rooms, I'm very sorry to inform you that I arranged to go on a trip to the Rocky Mountains." Actually, passing the exams never really occurred to him. That was an important part. It was matriculating in the college that was the thing that he was after, and he was having a fine time. He didn't really want to take part in the exams at all. Other students would take part in the pass exams, but survived to the end. So, in 1909, the Master of Cambridge's Magdalen College indicated that only a quarter of those people who'd matriculated actually took the degree. Very large numbers didn't take part in this. But pass degrees continued. Honours degrees became the thing that the aspirant people would take, but a pass degree would sit there. So by the time we get to the Robbins report, we have this confusion. There were still honours courses and pass courses. Some universities, you took the pass course and then moved on to the honours course. Some places you could be on both simultaneously and you would decide where to go, but they were still treated as separate. Quite often they were seen as the solution to the specialisation question. You take a pass degree, it was more general. Only those people who wanted to specialise could take an honours degree. But of course, we know, in the end, honours wins out. Pass becomes just the part that we now get to. If you don't succeed, you get a pass degree. But that was the original part. That was the original degree that everyone took.
Now, finally this week, we couldn't end the show without discussing the implications of the US presidential election. Brooke,
yeah.
Give us your thoughts.
Well, as the resident American here, at least on this podcast, it's been a tumultuous 24 hours. I know that, as I was just saying earlier, a lot of us who are Americans living abroad certainly feel like we're watching our childhood home catch fire and burn with our family and friends in it. It feels existential. But of course, our way through that despair is to try to find what we can learn about this and how we can use what we are learning to our advantages, either strategically or practically. And I think there probably are some reflections for us here in the UK as well. I think, I was listening to some Democratic strategists this morning kind of humming and hawing about what are we going to make of this and how are we going to use this to our advantage going forward? And actually, a lot of what they were wrestling with in my own reflections as a relatively new chief executive of a membership organization were not different to the sort of challenges that I've been grappling with, and it's about how can you can't just be a sum of your parts. You can't just be thinking, well, women only care about reproductive rights and Black voters only care about criminal justice. But actually, you have to have quite a broader message about purpose that everyone can see themselves in somehow. And of course, as the chief executive of Guild HE, which has an incredibly diverse, and in fact, I've been arguing the most diverse representative body in the sector, given that we have small and large and urban and rural and online and completely practice-based and privately and publicly funded institutions within our membership, actually it's hard to present an image that everyone can find themselves in, but indeed that is our challenge. And it is to our detriment to not do that because we're at risk, of course, of not representing them well, but also losing our way. And the thing I've been talking to the board about is finding that broader identity and broader message that not only our current members, but even future members could see themselves in. And I think that is applicable to, again, what Democrats in the states are thinking about now. You know, how has their message not landed well enough? It's clear to us that the kind of flummox with which we Democrats walk around thinking, you know, how could anyone choose to put a convicted felon, a sexual assaulter of women, a person who has put in Supreme Court justices to undo women's reproductive freedom, how could they ever put them into office, the highest office in the land? But indeed, Donald Trump has made gains across every demographic group, gains from his 2020 performance in 2024. So in fact, more people this year voted for him than in 2020, which tells us that as Democrats in the US, our kind of flummox or kind of, you know, consternation about what he represents isn't enough to attract people to our side. And likewise, we have to have a better vision of what it is we're trying to do. Likewise, I think here in the sector, as well as in the UK, you know, we need to recognize that we have to have a bigger vision. And I think it does tie back to some of the work we've been doing recently in the conversations we were just having a few minutes ago about radical efficiency. You know, this is the moment to think not about tinkering around the edges, not about saying to people, well, of course, you know, it's obvious we need just some more fees or we need just better public funding. And that's obvious because there are clearly people in this country that don't agree to that, don't sign up to that. And again, the kind of shell shock we feel this morning and yesterday morning as Americans is not dissimilar to the shell shock we felt here at the Brexit vote outcome. And so, you know, people who are much more eloquent about making political observations can draw together the threads that tie those separate events forward. But I think at the moment for us in the sector here, we have a couple existential and probably more immediate and practical questions on the back of Donald Trump's election. You know, existential really is, you know, how might we too look like we're defending a system that isn't working? That is what the accusation is being levied at Democrats' feet now. But I think it's cause for us to look at ourselves, those of us who are representing higher education, to kind of think about that. Do we have a higher message that's understood and communicated well to those who are less engaged with us? And that's really getting to that, you know, the kind of Trump-based question. But, you know, how far does our message about the value of higher education reach those outside of higher education? It's a question. Of course, questions about whether Donald Trump's kind of anti-woke positioning could stoke flames here again and introduce a greater degree of political volatility at a time that we're really just settling back into a better position with our own government. Slightly more positively, though, in terms of immediate and practical questions, does his election mean that we will see a slight increase to the number of international students who might choose to undertake study here, given that we saw numbers dip during his previous term and then recover with Joe Biden's administration? And of course, this is happening at a time that Canada and Australia are implementing less favorable policies for international students themselves. So that could be a short-term win for us. But again, we need to tread carefully in terms of how much we might rely on that funding stream itself. And of course, will, slightly less positively, will Donald Trump's America First position and the promise of higher trading tariffs that come along with that somehow depress or even slow the economic growth ambitions of the UK? And therefore, would it present greater challenges to us at a time that we're really trying to position ourselves as enablers of the Labour government's initiatives? So some food for thought, but thankfully, it's slightly too early to know the answers to those questions.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discuss today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on UKHE, do just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Brooke, Johnny and Michael. We'll be back next week with a live audience at the Festival of Higher Education. Until then, stay wonky.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs.